A German explorer and naturalist named Alexander von Humboldt was once the most famous scientist in the world. He inspired Darwin to go on his around-the-world trip. He showed Thoreau how to write Walden. There are more plants, animals, minerals, and places named after him than any other person. Oh, and he predicted man-made climate change in 1800. So how come most of us have never heard of this guy? Historian Andrea Wolf rescued Alexander von Humboldt this year with her biography, The Invention of Nature. It's on a lot of this year's best book lists, and Steve Paulson recently sat down with her.
Andrea, there was a time when Alexander von Humboldt was the most famous scientist in the world. He was widely revered. In fact, he was the guy who inspired Charles Darwin to go on his round-the-world trip on the HMS Beagle. And then today, outside of Germany, Humboldt has largely been forgotten. So take us back to Humboldt's day. What made him so special?
Well, he was, as you said, one of the most famous scientists of his age. And I'd like to say that he's actually mainly forgotten today in the English-speaking world. Interestingly, he is really super famous in Latin America, because one of the reasons why he was so famous is because he went on a five-year exploration of Latin America in 1799, just before his 30th birthday. And he came back from this exploration with a completely new idea of nature. He came up with this idea that nature is a web of life. He described Earth as a living organism, which are ideas which we still very much believe today.
So this is kind of 200 years before the Gaia theory surfaced in our own time.
Yes, and the amazing thing is actually that Humboldt wrote a book in which he described all this, which was called Cosmos, but while it was still in manuscript, he considered the title Gaia for that book, which I think is just extraordinary, don't you think?
Now, you mentioned Humboldt's extraordinary five-year journey down to South America, deep into the Amazon rainforest by canoe, also high up into the Andes Mountains. What was he after? What was he looking for?
He was an incredibly restless mind. He said himself that he always felt like as if he was chased by 10,000 pigs. So he's this incredible, curious person. And he believes that a scientist really has to leave their studies and their labs. They have to be out in nature. And the extraordinary thing about him is that he has an incredible memory. So his mind can race back 30 years later to a particular plant he's seen. So what he's doing is he's connecting the whole world.
And for much of his expedition, he was hauling around a lot of heavy equipment to measure yeah. everything that he was seeing. Tell me what his expedition was like.
So he leaves Europe with 42 scientific instruments, all wrapped individually in velvet-lined boxes. So he schleps those around South America. But what he does is, I mean, his story is really one of great adventures, because he was just so brazenly adventurous. So, for example, he paddled along the Orinoco and the surrounding river networks, 1,400 miles, 75 grueling days. And, you know, of course, this was incredibly dangerous. So they encountered crocodiles, snakes, jaguars, mosquitoes. Then he traveled to Cuba. He then went back to South America and traveled from the northern coast of what's today Colombia, 2,500 miles, all the way south to Lima in Peru, much of this through the Andes. This is, you know, some of the harshest landscapes you can possibly imagine. And he climbs every reachable volcano on the way. In fact, he climbs Chimborazo, which is then believed to be the highest mountain in the world. And he goes up to just under 20,000 feet and holds the world record for several decades. So he's a physically very fit man also.
Well, tell me about that climb, because it sounded like it was high adventure. I mean, something that easily could have killed him.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, so I followed a few of his footsteps. And so I went to Venezuela and I went up the Chimborazo, not all the way up. And I have to say that with every footstep I took, my admiration for him just grew, because, of course, he didn't have great climbing equipment and stuff like that. So he goes up Chimborazo and he describes everything kind of in great detail. So the weather is terrible. The whole mountain is basically covered in fog. Their eyes are bloodshot. Their gums are bleeding. They struggle to breathe in the thin air. The icy wind kind of numbs their hands and feet, and they're crawling up this kind of really narrow, high ridge. But he still stops every few hundred yards to take out his scientific instruments to measure everything. You know, of course you do that. And then they go on. And then at 19,000 feet, 19,400 feet, suddenly the fog lifts and they see this huge crevasse in front of them. So they can't go any further. But no one has ever been so high as they have. That's him and his traveling companion, the botanist Aimé Bonpland. And while Humboldt is standing there at the top of the world, really, his vision of nature clarifies and everything falls together. And when he comes down, he draws this incredible painting, which is a cross-section of the Chimborazo, on which he writes every single plant he's seen at a certain altitude. It's this incredible visualization of scientific data, which really he is the very, very first one to do so. Mm.
So he was mapping sort of the strata of plant life up and down the mountain.
Yes, and he realizes that a lot of the plants he was seeing there on his way up the Chimborazo were very similar to the plants he had seen elsewhere in Latin America, but also elsewhere in Europe. And he comes to this incredible conclusion that there are vegetation zones, global vegetation zones. No one had talked about this before.
And he had just some amazing experiences during his time in Latin America. For instance, you have to describe this experiment he had with electric eels. what was he doing there?
Everybody just loves that story. I have to say it's one of my favorite stories. Like many other scientists at that time, obsessed with something which is called animal electricity. They're kind of, at that time, believing that animals hold electricity. And he tries it out when he's still in Germany with frogs and fish and all kinds of stuff. And then he comes to Latin America and he hears about these strange things called electric eels, and they are huge. They're about 5 foot long, and they discharge a voltage of about 600. So, you know, you touch them and you're dead, basically. So he can't just go and catch them. So the locals come up with this brilliant idea because the eels live in the mud and ponds, so they get 30 wild horses and they charge the horses into the pond. Now, the horse's hooves then churn up the mud. So the electric eels panic and discharge their electricity. You know, a couple of horses drown. But then they just, by the time they've kind of discharged their electricity, you can then start touching them. So that's how Humboldt gets them. But he dissects them, and some of them a little bit too early. So at the end of a whole day of experiments, he says, you know, we were very fatigued because they did get a few shocks.
Kind of dramatic. I mean, the lengths that he would go to try to figure out things.
Yes. I mean, and he does these things where he, and I like that a lot about him also, that he believes that the indigenous people can tell him a lot of things. So he always questions them. He calls them like they're the best observers of nature. And he tries out all kinds of stuff. Some is dangerous, some is not at all. So, for example, he hears or he sees them being able to distinguish 15 different species of trees by tasting the bark of the tree. So he tries that out and he says, like, well, it tastes to me completely the same. He's fascinated by the poison they use. So he gets some, puts it in a container. The container leaks. It touches his clothes. He almost dies. I mean, it's just extraordinary what this man does.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned also that he often connected with the people he met there. And it's worth pointing out, I mean, he comes from what was then Prussia. I mean, from an imperial power in Europe. But he didn't seem to have that kind of colonial mentality that a lot of people of that age did have.
Not at all. So he's a great believer in the French and the American Revolution. And we have to point out that he's actually financing this exploration on his own. So he can do whatever he wants in a way. He doesn't have to obey the command of kings and queens. He's fascinated by the indigenous people. And unlike most European, he does not regard them as savages. And he returns, for example, with sketches of Inca monuments and Aztec manuscripts. He also never stops criticizing colonialism and slavery. I mean, he writes some very, very straightforward books about this. He becomes a very good friend with Simon Bolivar, who liberates the Spanish colonies later. And Bolivar later says that Humboldt had awakened South America with his pen. So his descriptions of South America as this absolutely beautiful country with gorgeous landscapes, it's almost like as if he reminded the colonists just how magnificent their continent was.
Yeah. So once Humboldt got back to Europe after this, you know, long 5-year expedition, he wrote a 34-volume account of his journey, and a chunk of it was a travelogue, which came to be very influential. How would you describe his writing?
So there are several very different types of books. So he does one type of book which has incredibly beautiful engravings. They were very, very lavishly produced and very expensive. Then he does kind of some straightforward botanical volumes and zoological volumes. And then, and that's, I think, the amazing publications are really, he writes a lot of books which are a combination of evocative landscape descriptions with scientific observations. And with that, he created a completely new literary genre, and one that still is, I believe, the blueprint of a lot of nature writing today, because he brings together his emotional responses to nature with the scientific observations. So, for example, he writes one book which is called Personal Narrative, which is half a travel account of his exploration and half scientific observations. It's a book that inspires Charles Darwin to actually board the Beagle. So he is incredibly influential on Darwin, but also on John Muir, for example, who has a lot of copies of Humboldt's books, which amazingly still exist in an archive in California. And when you open these books, you can see how Muir kind of underlined and wrote in the end papers. So reading these books is like listening to Muir having a conversation with Humboldt.
And also, same with Henry David Thoreau as well. I mean, wasn't Walden actually deeply influenced by Humboldt?
Yes. So, I mean, basically, everybody in the 19th century was influenced by Humboldt. But yes, Thoreau, for example, he leaves Walden Pond in 1847, and he then turns those 2 years into one of the most famous pieces of American nature writing, Walden. But he struggled to write the manuscript. Thoreau was finding it difficult to find a balance between being a poet and a scientist, because he was observing nature meticulously like a science, but he also obviously adored the beauty of nature. And he was devastated, and he just didn't know how to tackle it. And then he read Humboldt's Cosmos, and everything changed. And he discovered this new world where Humboldt described that you should use your feelings and your emotions to describe nature. And it was really an answer to his dilemma of how to be a poet and a scientist. And after he read it, he took out his manuscript for Walden and he completely rewrote it. So in a way, Walden is like a mini cosmos. It's a description of nature where everything is connected. It's a description of nature which is thumping with life. So there's a lot of inspiration from Humboldt in that book.
Andrea Wolf's biography of Alexander von Humboldt is called The Invention of Nature. The New York Times chose it as one of this year's 10 best books. Steve Paulson talked with her.